Welcome to Reconquest on the Crusade Premium Channel, part of the Veritas Radio Network. This is Brother Andre Marie coming to you from St. Benedict Center in Richmond, New Hampshire. Our websites are Catholicism.org and Reconquest.net. I can be reached by email at bam@Catholicism.org. That's bam@Catholicism.org. You can find me on Twitter at Brother_Andre. And I'm also easily found on Facebook. Just look for Brother Andre Marie and you will find me. This evening's episode is episode number 131, and we're calling it Ireland's Bloody Friday. My guest is C.J. Doyle, or Joe Doyle as I call him, and he's the executive director of the Catholic Action League of Massachusetts. He is a seasoned culture warrior fighting for the Catholic cause in Boston. And you can read things that Joe's written that are on our website at Catholicism.org. I'm going to have a link on the Reconquest.net page to some specific things having to do with this. Of course, we're talking about the horrible Irish referendum that happened on May the 25th. As we were recording this, it's a week ago this Friday, and therefore we're calling it, and I stole this from Joe. He had it in something he wrote. He called it Bloody Friday. So the name of the show was Ireland's Bloody Friday. And without any further ado, we'll get to Joe, and we're going to start talking about what happened and why. Good evening, Joe.
Good evening, brother. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, thanks for joining me, and I'm looking forward to a thorough discussion of the question, as thorough as we can get in 55 minutes. Why don't we begin, Joe, by your giving us first of all, your Irish credentials. You're 100% a son of Erin, correct?
That's correct. All four of my grandparents are Irish. Three of them came from Ireland, but I have no alien blood in me. Anyways, but we're very proud to be Irish, and I was raised by my maternal grandparents. My grandfather came from Loughrea in Galway. My paternal grandparents came from Dingle in Kerry. My maternal grandmother, who spoke with an Irish brogue, came from Newfoundland, where in Nova Scotia, in Newfoundland, you know, Nova Scotia has a Gaeltacht for Scots Gaelic speakers, and Newfoundland has a very thick Irish accent for people of Irish descent who live there. So I'm Irish on all sides.
So even the one that was in the New World, that was born in the New World, she grew up with an Irish brogue.
Yeah, she actually had a stronger brogue than my grandfather, which was amusing. It was considering he came directly from Ireland,
and she was Canadian.
yeah. Anyways, it's just very heartbreaking to see what happened. I never met a modern priest here in the Archdiocese of Boston that were as pious as my grandparents, and it was they had this tremendous faith that they brought from Ireland, and it's just as I said, extraordinarily heartbreaking and sad and tragic to see this national apostasy. Mm-hmm. And, 16 generations, 16 centuries, and more than 60 generations were loyal to our Savior and to his Apostle Patrick. And they suffered through famine and genocide and persecution and war and invasion from the Vikings to Cromwell to Henry VIII and Elizabeth, and to the penal laws, which Edmund Burke famously said were a model of vicious perfection, the most modern pre-totalitarian instrument of government repression. And having endured all of that, having fought the largest empire in the history of the world and successfully gained their independence, they now discard it, seduced by luxury and by the sexual revolution and by all of the allures of the modern world.
So, Joe, why don't we start by giving a rundown of what it was that happened on May 25th, and with some of the key statistics, just so that we get the magnitude of it.
On May 25th, there was a referendum to repeal the Eighth Amendment to the Irish Constitution, which had guaranteed the life of unborn children. And this was repealed by a simply overwhelming margin, 66.4% repealed in a country that's still, 80% identify themselves as Catholics. And what's worse here is the trajectory, because in 1995, when Ireland legalized divorce, the margin was 50.2%. Just half of the country voted for divorce in what was, by the way, a clearly rigged referendum. Not rigged in the sense of ballot fraud, but rigged in the sense of the government spent money to procure one outcome. It was something that would never be permitted in a state here in the United States or in a Canadian province. And then in 2015, they had the referendum on the legalization of sodomistic pseudo marriage, and that passed by 62%, more than three fifths. And now the legalization of abortion, and frankly, I would have thought there'd be more resistance to the legalization of abortion than to the legalization of this homosexual activity. And now this is passed by 2/3. So we've gone from half the country being for divorce to 3/5 of the country being for same-sex so-called marriage to 2/3 of the country being for the killing of unborn children. And this is simply unprecedented, brother. You know, not even in Nazi Germany did a majority of people vote for mass murder. You actually have a situation where you have 2/3 of the voters, about 1.5 million people, actually voted to commit murder. Mm-hmm. To exterminate the unborn, and these people will have innocent blood on their hands. So this is just an extraordinary embrace of evil. This is they've repudiated the author of life, and they've embraced the father of lies.
Now,
the gospel. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I wanted you to give the statistics, and I'm glad that you parametered those statistics and sort of gave the trajectory. Obviously, the picture is very, very bleak, because if you go by that trajectory, you're going from a modest majority, a modest simple majority for divorce, to a larger majority who were for sodomitical pseudo-marriage, to a supermajority who are for infanticide, for in utero child murder. This looks bleak. I should say something. There's going to be a lot of bad news in this whole thing, because we're going to be discussing bad and horrid news about church and state in Ireland, and possibly about church and the universal church. But obviously, neither you nor I would discount the virtue of hope, and that things could be remedied, and perhaps by the end we'll talk a little bit about the remedy. So for those people who think that this sounds intensely negative or like a bunch of complaining, just realize we're talking about a very dark reality. And before we can talk about solutions, we need to talk about what actually happened and how we got here.
Winston Churchill said during World War II, we shouldn't give a silver lining to retreats and call retreats victory. We should look reality in the face and realize when we've suffered a tremendous loss, and we have suffered, and we should look reality in the face and realize we've suffered a tremendous loss. And remember, Hilary Belloc famously said that the Catholic mind was whole and sane and lucid and perceived reality, and we need to perceive reality clearly here.
Yeah. So, I did want to make that little disclaimer for people who think that it might be very negative, because it will be. Joe, in discussing Ireland, no matter how bad the faith has gotten there, and I know that it's a bleak picture, we're not talking about a pluralist society. This is something that American audience needs to know, because we too often think of things in our own terms. But Ireland has traditionally been an overwhelmingly Christian nation, in which the dominant influence was always the Catholic Church. So, with that in the background, it seems that either the church has lost her influence, or churchmen have failed in her mission, or is it both?
It's both. If you just look at the numbers, Ireland before partition 100 years ago was about 81% Catholic and about 19% Protestant. And when they created Northern Ireland, it was a deliberate gerrymander to ensure a Protestant majority. And it was about 2/3 Protestant, about 1/3 Catholic. That left the Irish Free State, which became the Republic, which is what we have today, about 93% Catholic, or about 95% Catholic, and about 3% Protestant, mostly Anglican Church of Ireland. and you know, less than 1% for you know for other denominations, and about 1% unchurched. So you were looking at a society that there wasn't simply 9/10 Catholic; it was about 19/20 Catholic. It was overwhelming, and the Protestant minority was again around 3%. So, but what would be like about the same size as, say, the Jewish minority today in America would be. So it was an overwhelmingly homogeneously Catholic country that came into being in between 1916 and 1922. So you have seen both a tremendous loss of faith, tremendous apostasy. Right now, about 78% of people in Ireland identify themselves as Catholic. Now these people have not left to join other religions. This is just they've just become secularized. They've become nuns, as they call it, N-O-N-E-S.
Yeah.
No religion at all. And you've seen a tremendous drift away from the faith, and you've also seen a tremendous rejection of Catholic moral teaching, and I think you've also seen tremendous weakness in the church, and a complete, here's the same hierarchy, the same clergy that was able, again, stand up to the British Empire, and endure years and centuries and decades of persecution, and they seem completely clueless in the last 50 years. And I think you really, you know, can't avoid looking at the deconstruction of the traditional faith after the Second Vatican Council, the deconstruction of the traditional liturgy, the extinction of the sacrament of penance for all intents and purposes, the abandonment of the doctrine of no salvation outside the church, this kind of sappy ecumenism which promotes religious indifferentism, this modernism in Catholic intellectual life and in seminary education, and the homosexualization of the clergy, particularly bad in the Irish National Seminary, Maynooth, like the seminaries here.
Now,
many. Yeah.
For comparison, Maynooth was an elite seminary back in its day. I mean, they had too many seminarians. They were very demanding. Therefore, I mean, by too many, they had a lot of applications. So they could be extremely selective. So, I mean, I've heard of seminarians that were kicked out of Maynooth that went to other countries to become priests because it was just this priest glut in Ireland.
Yeah.
And so when we're talking about Maynooth, we're talking about an extremely elite seminary, and now that's become something of a cesspool of sodomy. And this is known. This isn't some conspiracy theory. This is quite well known. It's very public, right?
Yeah, it's very public, and it's, you know, we just had a latest scandal where supposedly the whistleblowers were, just like the United States a few years ago, the whistleblowers were removed, but the accused sodomites remained. There's now a more recent scandal where supposedly two seminarians were found in flagrante delicto, and the defense they made was that there was no carnal lust involved, that they were simply intemperate, they were under the influence of alcohol and ended up that way. So apparently alcoholism is to be preferred as a defense against sodomy. So this is just, again, the kind of scandals. And supposedly the Archbishop sent some of them to the North American College, the Irish College in Rome. Not the North American College, I'm sorry, the Irish College in Rome, thinking they would get a better Catholic formation there. So this is, again, you're kicking people upstairs that have a problem. And by the way, one of the reasons they had a glut of priests is because Ireland had a culture of life, and it was not unheard of to have an Irish family with 14 children in it. You know, it was large families produce vocations
and culture
to the priesthood, just the way large families produced vocations to the military. And so you had very large Irish families, and it was not uncommon for every family to have at least one priest and one nun in the among the siblings.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, Joe, before we go on, I'd like you to give you. You give me a rundown of the de-Christianization of Ireland. There's a piece that you put out, and we have published on our website in 2015, and we've recently updated it because you did.
Yeah.
And it's called A Chronology of it's Ireland, A Chronology of De-Christianization. Now, we don't have to go through everything, but if you could sort of give us the highlights, or as it is, the lowlights, beginning specifically in 1973, because I want to reserve what you mentioned about what happened in 1972 for its own separate question.
Sure.
But so what started the ball rolling, so to speak, in 73?
Well, in one way, there's a parallel to the United States because, you know, in 1965, 8 years before Roe versus Wade, we had Griswold versus Connecticut, which created this dubious right of privacy or misinterpreted the traditional right of privacy in the Fourth Amendment to of the U.S. Constitution to create a right, the so-called right of marital privacy, which meant the right to engage in any natural, carnal act that one wanted to. And it started with, my point is, in the United States, the revolution in some ways started with contraception, and it started that way also in Ireland. In 1973, the Irish Supreme Court declared a right to marital privacy, which includes contraceptive use, but declined to overturn the laws which had prohibited the sale of contraceptives. Then in 1979, the Oireachtas, the Doyleyrin and the Seanad, the Senate, the Irish Parliament passed something called the Health Family Planning Act, which allowed pharmacists to dispense contraceptives to those holding a prescription from a doctor. And this was the beginning of the legalization of contraception in Ireland. Now, in fairness to the government that did that, and the Minister of Health at the time was Charles Haughey, who later went on to become Prime Minister. Liberals at the time wanted a complete American British style regime of complete legalization, and Senator Mary Robinson, who later became president, was one of the proponents of this. And what Haughey did was he allowed contraception by prescription for married couples only. Now, at the time, the Irish medical profession was entirely pro-life and firmly so. So it was almost impossible to get a prescription for contraceptives in 1979. Oh, okay. So it was, even though this was not something, this Family Planning Act, which initially legalized contraception, was actually, it was a source of, it enraged the left in Ireland. It was they were upset. Now, this is not to say that Haughey was right in doing this, but he did attempt to deflect the momentum towards complete legalization. But unfortunately, it created the crack and the wedge which opened the door. And then in 1985, you had the Family Planning Amendment Act, which allowed over-the-counter sales of condoms and spermicides to anyone over 18. And then finally, I think it was 1992, you have another Health Family Plan Amendment, which allows basically the unrestricted sale of contraceptives to anyone over the age of 17. So between over a period of 13 years, between 1979 and 1992, you see the complete legalization of contraception. And of course, contraception is hormonal steroidal contraceptions are abortifacient. And they create chemical abortions of human embryos. So here you really have the beginning of the devaluing of human life. You have really the beginning of the abortion regime, just as it was in the United States, in Canada, in Great Britain. You have the beginning of the institution of abortion through contraception. Mm-hmm. I think this was a great tragedy. And then you also had, at the same time, the weakening of the laws against homosexuality. And you had in 1987, Ireland's first homosexual public official, a senator named David Norris, was elected. And he was a pedophilia defender. He's a vicious anti-Catholic bigot. He said St. John Paul II was engaged in wickedness. He was an instrument of evil. He called Benedict XVI a Nazi. And he would later run for president of Ireland in 2011, and his campaign would implode when it was discovered, as publicly revealed, that he petitioned the government of Israel for executive clemency for a convicted homosexual child rapist, who, by the way, had been his former partner in sodomy. So this is the first homosexual. He was a monster. He was a moral monster. He's still alive. And by the way, he's still a member of the Irish Senate. He's in his 70s now. But this man was clearly a moral monster, and he was elected in 1987. And then a year later, they had Norris versus Ireland, where the European Court of Human Rights, and this is another big part of it, both the United Nations and the European Union have been constantly pressuring Ireland for decades to promote this revolution in its morals. And both of these institutions are profoundly, militantly, and transitively anti-Christian, anti-Catholic. And you have both a carrot and a stick approach. You not only have pressure and demands and claims that they're violating like the European Code of Human Rights, but you also have it's not only the stick, but it's also the carrot. The EU gives Ireland infrastructure money. It gives Irish politicians commissionerships in Strasbourg. You get MEP status, member of the European Parliament status. You get chauffeured cars. You get all sorts of perks. You get pork barrel and patronage things for your constituency. So the European Union, at one point, the European Union agreed to give Ireland 14 billion quid in infrastructure money. So you have this regime of organized bribery by the European Union, and you have all this pressure from both the EU and the UN pushing the legalization of contraception, the legalization of abortion, the legalization of sodomy, the legalization of divorce. And we saw this, and then in 1989, you saw a law on the prohibition of the incitement of hatred, which again was to silence criticism of homosexuality. In 1990, Mary Robinson, a former senator who had been the leading advocate for the legalization of contraception, was elected president of Ireland. Now, that's a ceremonial position, not an executive one, but still it was a great defeat for Catholics and traditionalists in Ireland. And Robinson, by the way, was not only the nominee of the Labour Party, which is socialist, but she was actually endorsed by the Workers' Party, which is communist, which is Marxist-Leninist. So this was a watershed in 1990. Mm. And then, of course, in 1992, you also see the beginning of the abortion regime, and you see this whole series of things where you have this so-called X case, where a young girl threatens to commit suicide if she can't receive an abortion. So the Irish Supreme Court declares a right to abortion arising from suicidal ideation. And then you see a whole series of amendments which help further abortion. You know, one of the things we're seeing from this referendum is, I think, a very kind of illusory whistling past the graveyard attitude on the part of some Irish and American pro-lifers. They're saying the pro-abortion vote is soft, and the other side manipulated public opinion by talking about hard cases and saving the life of the woman and so on. But I think the reality is the pro-life vote is kind of soft, because if you look at the period in the 1990s, you see a series of constitutional amendments which approve the right of travel, meaning the right of Irish women to leave Ireland and go to England and procure an abortion. You see an amendment, again, passed by more than 60% for information on abortion. You see an attempt to overturn the X case, which allowed abortion in the case of suicidal ideation, defeated by about 60%. So you already see the beginnings of the abortion regime. And you also see in the 1990s the decriminalization of sodomy. And then in 1995, again, you have the government pushes this referendum on the legalization of divorce, which again is just 50.2%. And by the way, there's a great similarity here, and others beside myself have mentioned this, including former ambassador to the Holy See, Ray Flynn. There's a great similarity here to what happened in Boston, to what happened in Ireland, because the Irish Times, which is the ascendancy newspaper, of the old Protestant ascendancy, the establishment paper that would be the equivalent of the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Boston Globe, was breaking stories about clerical scandals, including Bishop Eamon Casey of Galway, who apparently had fathered a child, and God help us, actually apparently encouraged a woman that he had impregnated to have an abortion. So this is these horrible scandals in the Irish Church, and it was after this that the divorce referendum went through. And if you notice, in there's a parallel to Massachusetts, is of course it was after all of the scandals in the Church here and the resignation of condo law that we see the same-sex marriage decision here in Massachusetts. Okay. So there seems to be a playbook here on how to promote revolution in a Catholic society.
I have to do a little reset here. You're listening to Reconquest on the Crusade Premium Channel, part of the Veritas Radio Network. This is Brother Andre Marie, and I am discussing with my good friend and sometime guest here on the show, Ireland's Bloody Friday. We're talking about the abortion referendum that happened on Friday, May 25th in Ireland. So, Joe, I had to do a little reset there. Where were we on your timetable there?
Well, we were talking about how already in the 1990s, we're seeing the weakening of the laws against abortion. You're allowing women to go abroad and procure abortions in England. You're allowing people to get information regarding abortion, an attempt to overturn the X case, where the Supreme Court allowed abortion in the case of the threat of suicide. That was defeated in a popular referendum. So you see the people in Ireland, you know, endorsed the Eighth Amendment back in the 1980s to protect unborn human life, but then they've been weakening it constantly. So you see that the Catholic culture is weakening, and as each generation passes, it becomes weaker. And by the way, just a point about that referendum that on Bloody Friday, as I said, it was 66.4%. If you break it down, every single province and 25 out of 26 counties voted for it. Donegal, by a very narrow margin, voted against it. In Dublin, the capital city, the margin was 77%. The only subset of voters who voted against it were those over 65. 70% of all Irish women and 65% of all Irish men voted for it. And this is the real appalling statistic, brother. According to exit polls, 87% of 18 to 24-year-olds voted in favor of abortion, 87%. So it tells you that all of the young of Ireland have been completely, again, they've apostatized, they've been secularized, they've been completely de-Christianized.
That points to that trajectory that you referred to earlier, that this is simply going to get worse without some sort of intervention that breaks this cycle. This is going to get worse.
There was an old saying about Boston politics that every time you opened an obituary page in the 1940s and 50s, you saw the loss of another voter for James Michael Curley, because it was an older generation that voted for him. While, of course, the younger generation were so enamored of a family called the Kennedys. Uh-huh. And I think this is the same thing you're seeing in Ireland. The young people have been completely secularized. And, of course, there's no catechetical formation. They're completely illiterate in the faith, for one thing. And this is, again, is the failure of the church and the failure of the clergy and the failure of the religious and the failure of the hierarchy. And really have a younger generation that have, and of course they have no experience with the traditional mass or the traditional liturgy or the traditional teachings of the church, and their religious education is nominal and formal and vacuous.
Now, if we could go back, I know we did not finish your timetable, but there's a lot more to it. And listeners are invited to go to Catholicism.org and find it. You can go to Reconquest.net for this show on Ireland's Bloody Friday, and you will see a link to this chronology. But, Joe, I think it's important now that we go back tonight, because we should talk a little bit about causes of things here. Why don't we go back to 1972? Because you told me when we discussed this earlier that the repeal of Article 44 of the Irish Constitution is something that nobody's talking about in this connection, and I think we all know why. Once we realize what that repeal entails, it's sort of an indictment of Vatican II. So could you tell me, Joe, what happened in 1972 that you think sort of really started it all?
Well, again, you have so many people talking about the moral collapse in Ireland and about all of the legislative decisions and the referenda and the Supreme Court decisions and the High Court decisions, which is the appellate court. But it really begins the process of the juridical de-Christianization of the Irish state and of Irish society really begins in 1972. And that's the repeal of Article 44 of the Irish Constitution, which written by Éamon de Valera, the author of the Constitution, the founding father of independent Ireland, who was one of the great Catholic statesmen of the 20th century. And in it, de Valera wrote, "The Holy Catholic, Apostolic, and Roman Church is the guardian of the faith professed by the great majority of citizens." And this was removed in a referendum by an overwhelming margin. This is 1972 now, brother, 46 years ago, of 84%. And virtually all, now de Valera was at 90 years old and still the president. Again, the presidency was a ceremonial position, and he was actually still alive, and I think it was very heartbreaking for him to see this happen. But it was supported by virtually all political parties. There was a famous article in Foreign Affairs magazine, which is the official publication of the Council on Foreign Relations, and it was written by John Hume, who was the leader of the Catholic Party in Northern Ireland, the Social Democratic and Labour Party, and who was pro-life, by the way.
The CFR are globalists, right? These are one-worlders. These are globalists. The CFR.
If he's writing for Foreign Affairs, I presume so.
Yeah.
And he's dead now. He died a few years ago. But Hume was the head of the Catholic Minority Party in the North, the SDLP, Social Democratic Labour Party, and he had always been, in terms of moral issues, kind of socially conservative and pro-life. And he wrote in Foreign Affairs that the solution to Irish unity was to eliminate the confessional, quote unquote, the confessional character of the Irish state, meaning the Republic of Ireland, and presumably if you de-Catholicized Ireland, this would make the Republic more attractive to the Protestant minority in the North. Now, of course, it's been 46 years and there's been absolutely no movement, none whatsoever, on the reunification of Ireland. So as a pragmatic, practical decision, it fails by its own criterion. Mm-hmm. I think the sectarian issue of trying to appease Protestants, however, was simply a blind. It was a cover. What it was really was it was part of an effort by secularists, by secular humanists, by secular liberals, not just to de-Catholicize the Irish state, but to completely de-Christianize Irish society.
So this move in 1972 was popular. Why was the vote so popular? We're talking about a homogeneous Catholic society.
First of all, the bishops didn't, the hierarchy did not oppose it. The church went along with it. The clergy did not oppose it. The religious orders did not oppose it. The Catholic schools did not oppose it. And it was sold as an effort to unify Ireland. Now, this is, of course, a time of violence. This is one of the troubles started in 1969. And this is being sold by the media and by the political leadership as something that will help bring peace to Ireland. Of course, it didn't. The war continued until the 1990s, and Ireland remains divided today. So, again, this whole effort was essentially a fraud. It was an attempt, again, by secularists to remove the Catholic Church from the Constitution for its own sake, not for the sake of promoting Irish unity, but because they found the notion of a Catholic state and a Catholic society offensive to them. And of course, this is, of course, now 7 years after the end of the Second Vatican Council. The Holy See under Paul VI does not make any objection to this. This is the time where, concordats are being renegotiated to essentially, remember, the Vatican is trying to disestablish Catholic churches around the world.
Which happened in Spain, in Franco's Spain. Paul VI specifically asked for the Catholic Church to be disestablished in Spain, and also, I believe, in some of the Catholic cantons of Switzerland.
So, in other words,
fit in with Dignitatis Humanae. This fit in with the new doctrine concerning religious liberty, so called.
It was the triumph of John Courtney Murray, and it was something. It wasn't something that was done over the opposition to the church. It was something that the post-conciliar church embraced and promoted. So this is again a case of, to quote Paul VI, of auto devolutione. This is a case where the church participated in its own reduction in Irish society and its own removal from the Irish state. So if you're wondering why there was an 84% majority, supermajority, in an overwhelmingly Catholic and practicing Catholic country, it's because the leadership of the Catholic Church endorsed this, all the Catholic institutions endorsed it, and the leadership of the traditional Catholic political parties endorsed it under the guise of promoting national unification and bringing peace.
It was a deadly
move, however.
This serves as something, I think, as a parable for us. Yeah. When we're asked to capitulate our principles and our faith in the public sphere in order to promote peace, it's not going to promote peace. It's not going to promote unity. It's going to promote the dissolution of the Catholic side and the de-Catholicizing of the Catholic side.
Exactly. That's exactly what it did. And I believe that was the ultimate end of the people behind it. It was it was sold as a matter of promoting national unity and appeasing the Protestants. And by the way, the Protestants are still in the North holding firm on abortion. So if you wanted to have some kind of ecumenical outreach to the Protestant minority in Ireland, which are still a slight majority in the six counties, you would think that social conservatism and traditional morality might be part of that. So again, it was entirely liberals continually use sectarian divisions in Ireland to promote their own agenda and to de-Christianize the entire country.
You said the six counties when you're referring to the North, isn't it two counties?
Right.
Okay. Okay.
No, Ireland historically has four provinces: Leinster, Munster, Connacht, and Ulster. Ulster has nine counties. Three of those nine counties, including Donegal, which voted pro-life, are part of the Republic. Six counties and two independent boroughs, Belfast and Derry, are part of the North.
Okay.
So
okay,
what the British did was in when they partitioned the country, there were only four of the six counties had Protestant majorities. Two for Manor and Tyrone had Catholic majorities, but it was very close to 50%. So they were attempting to create the largest territory still consistent with Protestant majority status. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't take all of Ulster because all of Ulster would have been about 50-50 Catholic and Protestant, and the Catholics had a higher birth rate. So they took six out of the nine counties, counties,
okay.
Two Catholic counties, one Protestant borough, Belfast, one overwhelmingly Catholic borough, Derry. It's six counties and two boroughs.
Okay. Now, from what I've read, Joe, the pro-abortion side was very organized and very militant, even to the point of being intimidating in achieving their aims in this particular referendum. Did the church, and by that I mean the hierarchy, did they actually fight, or was there any of the Catholic faithful who fought as well, any of the laity?
Was conducted by the laity. I mean, the bishops do what bishops do here. They issue these kind of tepid, low-key, inoffensive pastorals. I recall, you know, when at the time same-sex marriage was being considered in Massachusetts, Cardinal O'Malley issued a pastoral saying that support for traditional marriage is neither bigoted nor sectarian, which, as Archie Munker would say, ain't that a kick in the head? But it was the same way in Ireland. They would say the Archbishop of Dublin said it would be a great tragedy to remove equality from the Constitution because you would no longer treat unborn children with equality. Of course, what we're talking about is either chopping them up through surgical abortion or vacuum suctioning them or scalding them to death with saline solutions or committing some other atrocity upon them. But nobody talked about mass murder. You know, Pius the 11th in Casti Canuvi said that the judges and the magistrates who failed to protect children and even betray them to the hands of doctors and others who would kill them, should remember that God is the judge and avenger of innocent blood. Even the Second Vatican Council said that abortion and infanticide are abominable crimes. And of course, in Catholic tradition, the willful murder of the innocent is the first of the four sins that cry out to heaven for vengeance. But that's not what you heard from the hierarchy. You heard something very low-key. Reasonable arguments, because reasonable arguments and a low-key approach does not defeat revolutionaries. And this is what they were dealing with. They were dealing with violent, fanatical revolutionaries who were determined to extirpate any last vestige of Catholicism and Catholic culture from Ireland. And they have largely succeeded, and they were celebrating in the streets. And of course, the celebration in the streets was not just the right to fornicate without the responsibility of children. It was not just a celebration of the capital sin of lust. It was a celebration of the defeat and destruction of Catholic Ireland. The homosexual prime minister, Leo Varadkar, has talked about the demise of the church. Something that would have been unthinkable again a generation ago. And one of the things I pointed out in our chronology is the minister for youth and children is an American-born woman, Catherine Zapponi. She's an open, formerly partnered lesbian. Her partner is dead now. But she was civilly married to a former nun. And where she and the former nun met? They were both studying together at Jesuit-administered Boston College.
This is
an example of how corrupt the Catholic Church is and how corrupt Irish society has become. And I think one of the things you also have to bear in mind with the hierarchy, not only did they fail to come up with really a vigorous defense, but they failed again, just as they do here in America, to police their own institutions and maintain the religious identity and the Catholic integrity on Catholic loyalty of their own institutions. About one third of all Irish priests belong to something called the Association of Catholic Priests. And this is to say it's modernist and heretical is really an understatement. It's a treacherous revolutionary group committed to, again, to de-Christianization. This Association of Catholic Priests, again, representing one third of Catholic priests, actually issued a statement saying that abortion is too complex and nuanced to be discussed from the pulpit. And they urged that no Catholic priest should try to tell people how to vote or engage in politics from the pulpit. Politics in the pulpit meaning to defend innocent human life from butchery.
Yeah.
So you have a third of the priests are open overt traitors to the faith and by the way, to their country.
Yeah. Now, Joe, you wrote that all four major political parties in the Republic support legalization of abortion.
Right.
Because, of course, as it is now, abortion's not yet legal. They've just removed the constitutional obstacle. Now that that's out of the way, it's a foregone conclusion that it's going to be legalized. But all four parties are for legalization, including Sinn Féin, which is the political wing of the IRA.
Right. These are parties that were founded by strong Catholics.
Yeah, Joe, are there are any
was
of these
founded by Arthur Griffith to give majority rule to a Catholic nation in 1905?
Are any of
Tina Fall was founded by Eamon de Valera in 1926. Fine Gael was founded by Liam Cosgrave. And by the way, Fine Gael sits in the European Parliament as Christian Democrats. These are all, even the Labour Party, which is now socialist, was at one time quite Catholic in Ireland. And you had a Labour leader who actually said that when asked about his views, he said, "I'm a Catholic first, an Irishman second, and a socialist third." So, which is not bad for a socialist, I think.
Yeah.
But all four of these political parties that are of nationalist and Catholic foundation have now completely repudiated the Catholic faith and Christian morals.
Are there any other political parties in Ireland?
No, none. Yes, there are some minor parties, but they're even to the left. There's a Solidarity Party, and there's a Green Party, which I don't think has any TDs anymore. And you had the Progressive Democrats, whose name I think tells you everything you need to know. And they were a left wing breakoff from Fianna Fáil. I think they've pretty much disappeared now.
So, the
tiny parties, the smaller parties, are even more to the left than the mainstream parties.
I see. So, is there any hope of an organized political movement to undo this? Or is it, do you know of any?
No. I can't imagine the circumstances. They're already talking. Just today they announced that there's going to have buffer zones, so pro-lifers can't, when they legalize it, won't be able to get near the clinics. And we're already seeing it, and they're aggressively pushing other aspects of everyone is talking about this referendum, and they should be talking about it. But this is only one of a half dozen things that have happened this year alone. In earlier in 2018, the lower house of parliament passed on its second reading something called the Provision of Objective Sex Education Bill, which would force Catholic schools to indoctrinate Catholic children with propaganda in favor of affirming abortion, contraception, gender dysphoria, that is so-called transgenderism and sodomy. The Irish Department of Education has just this year ordered Catholic schools to change religion classes. This is Catholic schools, not just state schools. Catholic schools to change religion classes from an opt-in to an opt-in requirement. They've also proposed something called an amendment to the Status Act, which would remove what the liberals and the media are calling the baptism barrier. Another, again, to this Orwellian manipulation of language, which would prevent Catholic schools from giving preferences in enrollment to Catholic students. So the revolution, brother, in Ireland is going at full steam. And this is this horrifying referendum and this horrifying repeal of the Eighth Amendment is just one facet of a multi-front, multi-flank attack on the Christian moral order, and it's accelerating. And there's no conscience clause in Ireland, in Irish jurisprudence. There's no First Amendment in Ireland. So I think Irish doctors and nurses and Catholic institutions and Catholic hospitals and pharmacists and just taxpayers and others and employers are going to face really a severe coercion and persecution from the government over this and other issues.
Now, I'm going to read you two quotes. One is from our mutual friend, Charles Colomb. He said this: "Make no mistake about it, the Irish did this to cock let's see, to cock a snook at the church. I guess that's a an Irish idiom. Make no mistake about it, the Irish did this to cock a snook at the church. And another person, a man named Ron Nunez, says the church could come out in support of a law protecting puppies. And just because the church supports it, people would vote for the right to kick puppies. So both of the...
I'm sure that's true in so far as there is a tremendous level of anti-Catholicism and anti-clericalism. And if you talk to people in the pro-life campaign, they were concerned about us here in America sounding too Catholic when we talked about Ireland abandoning her heritage and abandoning her religion, and saying, why don't we tone it down, because that would there's such tremendous hostility to the church. We want to make entirely secular arguments, which again I think was an error on their part. But I don't wish to lecture them at the hour of this tragedy. But while that's true, brother, I think you also cannot overstate the extent to which the Irish have been re-paganized.
That's the point.
Paganized in terms of their sexual ethics and their morals.
And this is the point we're getting at,
it's
Joe.
Just, and appallingly, the last time I was in Ireland, Dublin was filled with prostitutes again for the first time in 100 years. You have pornography in Ireland. You have all sorts of family breakdown. You have all sorts of increases in the rate of suicide. You have all the manifestations and all the dysfunctions of modern secular society have arrived in Ireland.
There was a headline in one of the newspaper articles that I looked at on it, and the headline was, "In stunning rebuke to the Catholic Church, Irish vote to approve abortion." So whoever authored that, and it was an American newspaper, I forget which, authored that headline, connected the dots that this is a rebuke to the Catholic Church. Why do the Irish people currently hate the church so much?
Well, one of the reasons that they hate the church is because the detritus of Catholic morality tells them not to do what they're doing. But beyond that, you've seen this tremendous amount of anti-Catholicism going on in the media over the various scandals in the church. And of course, again, the scandals in the church are largely self-inflicted, and they are occurring here and have occurred here. They are the result of the homosexualization of the Catholic clergy and the homosexualization of Catholic religious orders and religious life.
So it's sort of a self-perpetuating.
But the media has taken this and manipulated it and used it and exacerbated it and magnified it. And I think you have to bear in mind that the media is monolithically and hysterically anti-Catholic, and it's not only anti-Catholic for ideological reasons, it's anti-Catholic for personal and professional and financial reasons. If you are in the Irish media, Ireland is a small market, it's less than 5 million people, about 4.7 million people, and if you want to advance in your career and make more money and go to the top of your profession, you really want to go from Dublin to London. And the Irish media have a personal, professional, and financial interest in conforming to the values and thinking and the corporate culture of the British media. So again, it isn't just ideological with these nasty anti-Catholic bigots in the Dublin media. It's professional. It was they'll get ahead in their careers, and they'll get out of Ireland and go to England if they are sufficiently anti-Catholic. You know, Eamon de Valera, the founding father of Ireland, people derided him as a romanticist and a nostalgia buff for wanting to bring back the Irish Gaelic language. But de Valera's purpose was quite calculated. He believed that so long as Ireland remained an English-speaking country, it would be under the cultural influence of Fleet Street. It would be dominated by the British media, by the British press, and would be part of the larger Anglosphere. And he was correct about that. And, you know, Ireland really has become a secularized Anglo-American cultural province. So there is a tremendous hostility to the church, but it's also, again, this paganization of Irish morals. I recall, this is just a horrifying incident. I was in the Our Lady Shrine in Knock about 25 years ago, and it wasn't in this brutalist architecture, modern basilica. It's the old apparition church, beautiful old church. And it was about the time, it would have been 1992, when contraception was being legalized, and there was an elderly priest doing something that I never saw happen in the United States. He was actually preaching against contraception, and two guys, fairly young guys, but not teenagers, guys probably in their 20s, 30s, in the back of the church, now this is Our Lady Shrine in Knock, stood up and began shouting obscenities at him. This is 1992. So the Irish, now this is before all the news about the scandals broke. And so this was an advanced paganization, de-Christianization, secularization. And I think, you know, the scandals were an excuse and were a catalyst and certainly exacerbated it. But no, it goes beyond that. I think, you know, one of the points I make about the scandals in Boston was that the scandals on regarding Cardinal Law and the Archdiocese were uncovered in January of 2002. But there were two votes in the Massachusetts legislature in October of 2001. One was on domestic partners, and the other was on what we now call Obamacare, a contraceptive mandate in group health insurance. And one passed unanimously, and the other passed 39-1. So the public influence of the church here in Massachusetts was already dead. Society was already de-Christianized prior to the scandals. And the scandals, you might say, were the coup de grace. They were the ones that finished off the church. And I think that's the case in Ireland. I think the faith was already dead, was already running on fumes, at least. And the society had already been substantially de-Christianized prior to the scandals. The scandals have just added to the, have just been you might say, the final nail in the coffin.
Joe, when you spoke about the outside influence of the UN and the European Union over the decades, putting intense pressure on Ireland in all of these different aspects of social teaching. Was there pressure from the United States, or if not direct political pressure, which would be impossible, at least social pressure?
Well, there certainly was a tremendous amount of American money. The same-sex pseudo marriage referendum was largely funded with American money, and there was an Irish American homosexual named Chuck Feeney, a billionaire who gave tremendously to the homosexual side. You get a tremendous amount of money coming from liberals in the United States going into Ireland. In all of these things, the Catholic side is always outspent by you know, several orders of magnitude. And so the old saying is that the three most important things in politics in ascending order of importance are money, money, and money. And our side never has money, and the other side always does. And I don't want to just reduce it all to that, but that you can't, that it's something you can't avoid talking about either. So there's a tremendous amount of American money. American multinational corporations, you know, certainly played a role in both of these referenda, the 2015 one and the 2018 one. In 2015, you actually had overt pressure from American corporations because their own corporate policies were in favor of you know, homosexual sensitivity training and so-called gay rights and support for same gender so-called marriage. So you have the influence of these American multinationals, and of course you have the influence of the American media and just the American culture. You know, for many years in Ireland, the most popular television program was that wretched soap opera Dallas, and it was a story about carnal relations and revenge and treachery, and that was very popular in Ireland. Law and Order, the other American television show, which is viciously anti-Catholic, has also been a very popular show in Ireland. So you have the worst of Hollywood affecting Ireland. Almost all of the Irish in Hollywood came out for the support of abortion. Liam Neeson, the famous Irish actor, actually did a really vile, vicious anti-Catholic commercial a few months back, talking about the darkness on the land, and the darkness is you see images of crucifixes and Celtic crosses in Catholic churches, and how this oppressed Ireland for centuries, and we now have to escape from this. And Bono of U2, who was everybody thought was some kind of a Catholic, and was involved in various Catholic charitable enterprises. He came out for the legalization of abortion. So Hollywood was for abortion. American money was for abortion. A lot of Irish Americans were for abortion. American corporations and multinationals were for abortion. And I would presume that the organized forces of abortion, like Planned Parenthood and NARAL and so on, also joined in these efforts. And of course, the American media, to the extent they covered it, you look at the coverage in the New York Times and the Boston Globe and so on, the Washington Post, was of course entirely in favor of the pro-abortion side. I mean, they actually you had someone in the New York Times, a woman in the New York Times last week, talk about Ireland became anti-choice because of the dictates of the Catholic Church towards women. Of course, besides the very pejorative wording of this, it's also just absurdly inaccurate from a historical standpoint. Ireland was made abortion illegal in 1861, and it was an act of the British Parliament in which Irish Catholics were a tiny minority. So it was a British Protestant government that actually outlawed abortion in 1861.
So Joe, we've got
the establishment of the state. All of the Protestant churches until the Lambeth Conference in 1930, they were against both contraception and abortion.
Mm-hmm. We've got a little under two minutes, Joe.
Catholic issue, and it is.
Yeah, we've got a little under 2 minutes here, and I wanted to make a point, just sort of dovetailing with what you said about Eamon de Valera being thought a romantic for wanting to have Gaelic be revived as the national language of Ireland, so that you'd have this sort of cultural linguistic barrier to protect the faith and culture of the Irish people. There was a missionary priest that I'm aware of. His name was Father Shine. He was a missionary in Africa for decades, and he came back home to Ireland from the mission field in the 70s and was disillusioned to see the change in the mass, the change in the culture, the change in the West, all these revolutions. But one thing that most disturbed him, and this was related to me by somebody who knew him, was that when he got back to Ireland, he saw that all of the houses had aerials, you know, antennas, and that all of those aerials were taking in signals from the BBC. So that their British would-be overlords were propagandizing them through television for, you know, these sort of Anglo-Protestant values that we find so repulsive.
Most of the television, most of the radio, most of the press is British in Ireland. And if it isn't directly British in the sense of, you know, a British newspaper, it's something that's British owned or British influenced or has Catholics, Irish Catholics working for them who aspire to work for the British in London. So it's again, the entire media culture has been anglicized and is anti-Catholic.
Well, Joe, I'm afraid that we've come to the end of our time. Thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, brother. It was a delight to be here. It's a sad subject to talk about, but I think, you know, again, we need to talk about it lucidly to address it. And by the way, I got a wonderful email from somebody today saying that Ulster is still, for now, pro-life. And remember, Ulster was the province of St. Patrick. It's in Ulster that St. Patrick created his first primatial see of Armagh. So perhaps if Ulster can hold firm, the rest of Europe will eventually be re-evangelized from Ulster, just as in the days of St. Patrick.
Okay. Well, thanks, Joe. You've been listening to Reconquest on the Crusade Premium Channel. God bless and Mary keep you.